Well, hi, everybody. My name is Laura, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am grateful to finally be here. It feels just like it did when I left here a little over 18 months ago. It's hot, it's humid, it's sticky. And I got off the airplane last night, and I grabbed the rail to walk down the steps, and it slid a few inches. I went, I remember the moisture. It's not like that where I'm from right now. It's very, very, very cold, although it was supposed to hit 50 today. I left, and it got warm. I don't know. That introduction threw me for a little bit of a loop. I wasn't expecting to take that roller coaster ride so early before I started speaking. But, Ian has seen me go to a new bottom in recovery and pull myself up. And I'm real happy to be here to share that. I'm happy to be here and sober. I was going to start out with saying how happy I was to be here to talk about my favorite subject, which is me and my recovery. I have to add that on there, really. No, it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be somewhere in my life where I actually have something to give to other people and something that I'm willing to give and I want to give, and it's exciting to have something to share with other people, because I was a very selfish and self-centered, egocentric maniac with low self-esteem for a long time before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in July of 1985. Before that, I drank like probably most everyone in the room, and I used as many drugs as I could get my hands on for the thrill of trying a new experience. But before I get to that part, I'll give you a little history about me as a person. I was born to two loving parents. Couldn't love each other very long, but they loved us. There were four of us kids. I have two older sisters, and then myself and a younger brother. And they were, now looking back on a geographical escape all the time. They moved around a lot when I was little, and they divorced when I was five. And my mother quickly remarried a man who had custody of his two children because his wife was suffering from the disease of alcoholism. So then I ended up with three older sisters, an older brother, and a younger brother. And the six of us kids and my new father and mother moved from Southern California up to the state of Washington, where we resided for about a year, and my stepfather lost his job. And, you know, I look now as a mother back at my mother, and I don't know how she did it. But she did it. She held us together, and we then moved to the Chicago area where I spent the rest of my life growing up. My dad quickly remarried, of course, and he married a woman who had three children. And to no surprise, her husband later died of alcoholism. And it's kind of this family disease. We all seem to sort of either find them or become one, I guess, in my family anyway. I've certainly found a number of them besides becoming one of them. Anyway, somewhere in the history of my growing up, it was pretty well known in our family that I was kind of my dad's favorite. And it was okay because I was the youngest daughter, and I had a lot of sicknesses when I was born. And I'm sure that there was some envy between my siblings and myself, although I don't think I was aware of it. If you've done any work on your family position, I was that lost child. I really didn't make too much noise anywhere along the line, although I was able to nurture my disease as we went along. So most of my life, I spent the school year with my mother in Chicago, and then I would spend the summers with my dad in California and that whole family. And my parents have pictures of me when I was small, when they were still married, and they used to have these parties in their garage. And, you know, denial, gosh, it just runs so deep sometimes. You know, I'll look at those pictures today and go, wow, look, I have all the symptoms. They're all over my face, and I'm holding somebody's drink in my hand at 2 1/2 and tasting it. And my mother would say, oh, yeah, we used to laugh at you. You'd walk around, you'd taste everybody's drinks, and we thought it was cute. I don't know that I think that's so cute today, but I am sure at that point that I loved it. I was thinking the other day about consuming alcohol, and I don't know that I ever liked any of the flavors, to be real honest, but I loved the feeling that came along with it. I know that there were times when I would take drugs, and I didn't like the taste in my mouth, but I loved what it did for me. And I must have loved it 2 1/2 what it did for me, because I don't ever remember a time thinking that I didn't want it. I always wanted it. Anyway, so we had some geographical moves back and forth, and life was pretty chaotic, I think, for the most part, if I look back. Somehow, stayed together. Our family did strange things, like my two older sisters got on airplanes in the middle of the night and flew to California because my dad would secretly send them a ticket and my mother would freak out and then the rest of us would pay the price for it and then things would calm down and my mother would fly to California and get my sisters and bring them back. And that's the kind of house I grew up in. I'm sure I was constantly looking for some sense of stability. And I know that I started to find it in outside sources. I found it in food for a number of years before alcohol and drugs became easily accessible to me. I was always the fat sister. Everyone was older than me was always thin, and they would, you know, add to my low self-esteem by calling me names. And you know what? I love them all today for it because it's something I've been able to look at and own in myself that I don't have to think that way about me anymore. And that's really not what God intended for me to feel like. So anyway, before I jump too far ahead of the game, in the seventh grade, my stepbrother that was a year older than me decided he was going to go live with his mother in the state of Washington, and so I decided I was going to take permanent residency with my dad in California. And I left my mother, and I went to California for the eighth grade. During that year, I gained 45 pounds, and I discovered amphetamines and barbiturates because I had these two older stepsisters. And I really discovered booze because it was accessible. Everywhere. I would go to their dad's house out in the desert and we would experiment with new drugs and alcohol. And anyway, during this time, and I can share this early in the story, my dad's in recovery now and his alcoholism was certainly blooming and blossoming and getting way out of control as well. It was a turning point in my disease. I had my first blackout on my 13th birthday and I remember no sense of remorse about what I had done, wishing I had been able to do it differently so that I could remember all the things that happened, but knowing clearly that when I drank, something happened, and I liked what that was all about. A little bit scary, but not scary enough, and I don't know if anyone in the room can relate to, I was never scared enough not to pick up a drink. It didn't matter what the threat might be or what the consequences might be. It just never kept me from picking up that drink. And today I can tell you it's that fear of not having the fear that keeps me from picking up the drink. If I even think about picking up, I am clear what the consequences would be today, and I'm afraid of not being afraid of that. So that's just a little thing that helps keep me going. So after coming to on the morning of that experience, all I can remember was that my dad was looking down at me with total disbelief, and I was asked to clean the bathroom. And I went in, and sure enough, there was the proof that I had had too much to drink the night before, and it was everywhere but where it should have been. So even that wasn't enough to keep me from thinking that I shouldn't drink again. I started the obsession right then of when would be my next drink. In fact, I'd have taken a drink if I could have had one just to ease the pain that I was feeling inside and that new hole that was empty and waiting to be filled up one more time. So after a year, I think somewhere I must have had enough sense to know that this wasn't a good position for me to be in, and I returned to Illinois and finished high school and got a job on a dude ranch. I'm a dude ranching kind of gal. Love horses. About 5 years into sobriety, I had to ask myself, honestly, did I really love trail riding or did I just like trail riding because it was one long drunk? And I'm still not sure. I do love horses, but I'm sure my motivation for most of those trail rides was one good long hammered weekend. So anyway, after my first year at the dude ranch, I decided that I was going to take a vacation with this guy friend of mine, and we headed from Illinois out to Montana. Yeah, we were real cow people. And when we got to Montana, you know, to no surprise, actually I was thinking about this when I was thinking about what I would talk about today, the risks that we took for such, maybe I was 19, I don't even know how old I was, but, you know, we stopped in Wisconsin, and we stopped in North Dakota, and we stopped everywhere, and we found people who could get us drugs. And I think to myself, I hope my children don't do that, because I'm scared for me now, and it's several years past that 19-year stage. Anyway, we got to Montana, and you know what? We didn't have any money to go any farther. We couldn't buy any gas. We couldn't buy any food. Well, I knew better than to call my mother. My mother is the Victorian type. She didn't understand the fact that I was traveling across the country with a man, and so I called my dad, who was far more lenient. He'd had a couple of wives by then, and he was a party guy. So anyway, I said, hey, Dad, we're in Montana, and we don't have any money, and he sent us some money, and we went on down you know, if you think geographically, Montana is just north of California, and Illinois is pretty far east, so we decided we would go to California. Took up residency for the year, and I didn't have anything else to do. I had a year of college under my belt, and I had left with a 1.7 average on a 5-point scale, so I wasn't really doing very well. And, I got a happy ending to that story, too, but... we lived with my dad for a very brief period of time, and surely there's at least one person in the room that could relate to the lifestyle he was living. A brothel comes to mind. You know, I'd be at school in the day, and Tim, who later became my first husband, by the way, he went to work construction, and we'd come home, and you could just tell that there'd been something going on in the house. You know, it got to a point where we were afraid to climb in the bed that we were sleeping in because we don't know who'd been in there earlier. It was a wonderful experience for a 19, 20-year-old girl to have. And the unfortunate thing was is that our diseases were all really rapidly progressing. And one day we came home, and I can relate to that kind of anger that comes out of nowhere and it doesn't really have a solid base to it. And my dad looked at the two of us and he says, you know, I'm sick and tired of you guys living here. You owe me $3,200. And we didn't have any money. And I said, Dad. And he said, okay, well, here's your choice. It was certainly not this nice, but it was to the extent that, you know, you either leave with him or you stay here with me and he goes. And I looked at the two of them and I thought, listen, I got this drunk, insane father here. And I got this guy who maybe cares a little bit about me. I'm going over here. And I also was going to prove to him that, you know, he wasn't a worthless son of a... So, anyway, it was a very long 9 years after that before my dad and I talked again. During that 9 years, it was shortly after that that we left California since we didn't really have family support anymore. We decided to go back to Illinois. And we got married, and my dad didn't come to the wedding. I have had, at that time, a lot of strong, frequent visits with my siblings, and my dad is fairly well off financially, and I would go to their homes, and each of them would have, you know, the same microwave oven. I didn't have one. Or they'd have the same color television, and I didn't have it. Many of my friends thought that my dad had passed away because I just never talked about him, and I didn't know how to, have a relationship really with anybody, let alone with a secure enough one to talk about what had happened with my father. And like I said earlier, he was really my hero when I was little, and I knew that I was really his favorite. So a lot of that drove me to drink, and a lot of the drinking I did was to anesthetize that emptiness and that loss. My alcoholism escalated after that. Somehow I managed to get through school and get a degree. I had taken a job in a Sears catalog store, and most of us alcoholics are really brilliant people if you don't already know that. And I would go to work and I think, God, I can run this business way better than this guy can run it. And so, you know, pretty soon I had a major resentment and I had to quit that job and go find a way to do something better than I was doing there. And I did. I'm kind of driven by that. I don't know if anyone here is ever satisfied with what they have, but I just always think it can be better. It doesn't matter, you know, from Ian's laughing over here. It doesn't matter what it is. I can always make it better. That's just part of my drive. Anyway, I already said I finished school, and I became a professional, and I was married to this man named Tim, and somehow things just needed to be better, and that marriage didn't make it. I will hopefully remember to talk about that later on in my story, but... you know, I started to have wandering eyes, and things looked better on the outside. So the marriage ended, and I bought my first little piece of property. It was a 6-acre Armet. The house was 800 square feet, and the barn was 3,500 square feet. Now, tell me, where were my priorities? I was living with a gentleman who had, I think he had 7 or 8 horses. I had one, you know. Ladies, maybe you can relate to that. You know, I'm going to provide this home not just for him, but also for all of his horses. It was, some people are laughing. That period of time was a good time in my drinking memory because I surrounded myself with people. There were, you know, anywhere from 20 to 30 of us who would trail ride on a regular weekend, and now I had this new place where people would come. I am not an isolationist, and I did not drink alone. A lot of people do that. I can't stand to be alone. I don't even like to be alone now, and I've learned to like myself. The other day, I had a five-minute, what I call can't stand to be alone with myself time at work. I had absolutely nothing to do, and I had to pick up the phone and call another alcoholic and just say, I have 5 minutes before my next appointment, and I cannot stand to be with myself right now. And it was great because, you know, that 5 minutes turned into 10 minutes, and I felt really good about me, and she felt really good about her. So that was really, that's the kind of drunk I was. I couldn't drink alone. So in order to assure that I couldn't drink alone, I maintained 10 cases of Pabst Blue Ribbon Light in my basement. Some people enjoy that beer. I bought it because it was cheap, and I bought it because I knew that most of the people who came over would drink it. And it did have a stash of better beer that nobody knew about. And I always managed to always have a bag of dope around the house. That was my security blanket, and that's how I filled me up. I had enough money to have that supply, and I had enough friends to keep them coming around. And that's pretty much where my using level was at that time. Where I was personally was at a stage where there was nothing about me that I could stand, to be real truthful. I was in a profession that I served other people, and I was trying to write out some things before coming down here. Actually, I've been thinking for a whole year about what I was going to say today, and when I almost didn't get here, I was working on a resentment. You know, I spent 12 months thinking about what I'm going to say. I better get there. Then this morning, I couldn't remember a word of what I wanted to say. Anyway, I read a meditation the other day, and the key word was motivation. And it really hit me about where my level of motivation for living was before I got sober. I could have cared less. In fact, many, many mornings, I prayed that my eyes wouldn't open. I was too chicken to take my life. I knew that. There was no way, although I was slowly killing myself with drugs and alcohol, there was no way I could have done a suicide mission. But I really asked God to please don't wake me up because I just couldn't take another day. I didn't know how to walk through a day with a moment of peace, let alone happiness. And, you know, the demons were in there all the time. You're less than, you're no good, you're a waste, you're a fake, someone's going to find out who you are, you're really not as cute as people tell you you are. You know, the guy you're living with is really taking all your money and you don't know it. And, you know, paranoia to the 10th degree. That's where I was with me, faking it, trying as hard as I could to get through one more day and waiting for the next drink. I was a daily drinker. I told myself I never went to work drunk, but, you know, after a 4 or 5 day trail ride, and you don't get in until, you know, 2 o'clock Sunday night and you've got an 8 o'clock appointment, you're probably still under the influence. And I was wishing I could go back and make amends for some of that today, and I know that's impossible, and I know that God knows in my heart. I'm sorry for the service I delivered that wasn't to the best of my ability. And today I can tell you that if I don't serve to the best of my ability, I make things right. And that's a good feeling, and it's honorable. It makes me feel good, and it gives me that motivation to get up tomorrow and try and do it just as good or better than I did it today. Anyway, it was on a Wednesday at the very end of June that I received a phone call at 3:30 in the afternoon from a counselor at a treatment center in Southern California who started the conversation out by asking me if I would be interested in attending a family treatment week. And, of course, I had heard through the family grapevine that my dad had gone in for treatment because, you see, he tried to kill his third wife. And like any good alcoholic, when they gave him the choice between going to jail and going to treatment, he chose treatment. So I'd already heard that story from my sisters, and I said to the gentleman on the phone, oh, is this in relationship to my dad? He said, well, it's an anonymous program. We can't tell you who's here. Well, I knew it wasn't my mother, and I knew that my sisters and brother weren't in treatment. So I then, in a very pompous and arrogant manner, asked the man if he was aware that my father hadn't talked to me in almost 9 years. And his response to me was, well, then it seems like it might be beneficial for both of you if you could come. Today, I would warmly welcome a suggestion like that. Almost 18 years ago, I used the F word and hung up the phone, and I thought, how dare him? You know, I suddenly became a victim, and why would anyone think that I would take that kind of time and energy and spend that kind of money to fly all the way from Chicago to Southern California to help someone who had been so mean to me? So this today, I can tell you, was the beginning of God doing for me what I could never have done for myself. And I didn't know it. Feelings started to churn inside of me, and I desperately called my two sisters, who already had their airplane tickets, you know. That didn't set very well, and of course there was just a little bit more of a spur that, ooh, maybe I should do this. So I had plans with some friends of mine to drive to Memphis, Tennessee for the 4th of July. So I thought, well, I had to be in California on Monday the 8th, and I thought, okay, well, I will just fly out of Memphis. So I got a ticket from Memphis to Southern California with a layover in Dallas. And as we got closer to the 4th of July, my friends decided not to go to Memphis. So then I needed to get a ticket from Chicago to Memphis, which had a layover in Indianapolis. And I was thinking to myself, why would I do this? You know, this is 4 airplanes. Where I lived was 90 miles west of Chicago, and so I had a friend drive me to the bus in Rockford, Illinois, which was about a 45-minute drive, and then I took an hour and a half bus ride from Rockford to Chicago, and then those 4 airplanes in total. It took me almost 27 hours to get to California. Willing to go to any lengths? And there was no willingness on my part, but certainly my higher power had some willingness that needed to get me there. And for anybody who drinks on airplanes, you know that's what I did all the way. I drank. And drank and drank and drank. A girlfriend of mine picked me up because I hadn't quite met this third wife yet in my dad's life, and there wasn't any way I was going to share myself with someone I didn't know. So that was a Saturday, and they picked me up on Sunday, my two sisters and Judy and myself, and we drove to the treatment center. We checked into our own room. The three of us girls had our own room, and Judy had her own room. Judy's not in the picture anymore. Sometimes that happens when one alcoholic gets sober and the other one doesn't. That marriage doesn't work, and it's okay today for everyone. Anyway, I remember that feeling of being very fearful of what we were about to experience. I had no idea about anything that had to do with recovery or alcoholism. I knew that AA stood for Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was it. I didn't know anything about 12 steps, higher power, sponsors, sponsees. I didn't know any of that vocabulary. And yet, the very first morning at 8 o'clock, we checked in, had to surrender all of our drugs that we were taking. I mean, why? So we saw, at 8:15 in the morning, we saw a film. And every time I tell my story, I ask if anyone in the audience could come up and tell me afterwards if they know the name of this movie. It was about a 15-minute clip with Patty Duke and some guy with red hair, and he's real big. And you know, I can't tell you anything except that I knew that that was me, both Patty Duke and the husband. I was both parts in the movie, and by 8:30, I was convinced that I was an alcoholic. Although I didn't want to believe that, and I certainly would not have admitted that to a soul, but I could relate to the behavior and the feelings that they were talking about in this movie, and I thought, oh my gosh. So just a little tiny crack in my door of, you know, maybe I should investigate this thing about alcoholism started to happen. And the week was the longest week of my life and also a pivotal point for who I am today. My two sisters, you know, they loved me enough to know that I could say goody two-shoes. They desperately said, oh, let me take that, you know, yes, no, alcoholism checklist. And I went, oh, I'm not taking that. I don't need to know. I knew in my heart, I think. Well, part of their policy was there. If you were there for the family week, you couldn't talk to the alcoholic. If you saw him, you could wave, you could give him a hug, but you know, you couldn't really spend any time with him. For me, that was great because I hadn't talked to him in 9 years, and I didn't know what the heck I was doing there anyway. And I remember each time I would see my dad, that there was that sense of when I was little and our relationship time would kind of move in a little bit, and then I would be afraid about the first time that I had to actually talk to him. And we all had our counselors, and you know, the end of the week came and it was time to exit. You know, they asked me if I wanted to stay a second week. They didn't ask my sisters. My brother didn't go, by the way, but they didn't ask my sisters. And I know today that alcoholic part of me that's going to prove to everybody else how wrong they are is what kept me sober. After I got home, I wished I had stayed a second week because I was too scared to go out of my own house for a long time. But, you know, please stay another week. I don't have to stay another week. I've learned everything I needed to know about getting my life back together in 5 short days. Whew, I don't even have it after all this time, but I didn't know that then. Anyway, I do need to share that the exit time where the my two sisters and myself and my dad and my then stepmother got together to make direct amends was the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. Harder than having children, harder than finishing my doctorate degree, harder than anything I have ever done in my life. I was so scared of having an amends made to me, as well as being asked to make amends for the things that I had done, which were the best that I knew how to do. I remember what seemed like a half a day of tears in a room, and really, I don't know if anybody even said anything to each other, but there was, for me, the beginning of learning how to be myself and to let people be who they needed to be with me and to accept apology, which is, for this alcoholic, one of the hardest things. I can be flippant about, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And I still, to this day, when someone says, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, inside go, yeah, right, you know. I don't say it anymore. I just hear the voice inside and say, okay. And I try to be grown up and mature and to feel that feeling, because when I feel that feeling, life gets better each time I let it happen the way God intended it to happen. And so it's important to share that for anybody who hasn't had an opportunity to make direct amends to someone. Doesn't mean that it makes it any easier today to do it, but it, for me, means that if I do it, life is going to get better. And as long as life keeps getting better for me, I'm not tempted to pick up a drink or a drug. And so I have to do that footwork to get there. From that point, my relationship with my dad has continued to blossom to a point where I now am so afraid that he's going to go before me that I can't imagine life without him. I hate it when I do that. He's someone I call all the time, daily. I mean, actually, if we don't talk at least 5 days a week, one of us is on vacation. I guess that's, and even on vacation. I mean, I called him last night at midnight to let him know that I finally got here. Called him from Detroit when I was stuck and they were fixing the brakes. I just need to let you know that if there's someone in your life that you were close to once before and you can't be close to him now, do the work. It's worth it. I believe that God intended for us to be close and to be of service and to be of help with others. And you can get there. By taking those little steps one at a time, just one day at a time. And he's really the important, most important part of my recovery. And I'm sure I'm his because we have that common bond. Anyway, when you talk about your recovery and what we were like and what happened and what it's like now, that's what happened. For me, I had doors start opening. And I am certainly not an expert on relationships. I have to lighten this up a little bit here for myself. But I do know that each relationship I get into, whether it's with a friend, a girlfriend, a male friend, or a significant male, or whatever it is, that each time I learn a little bit more about who I'm supposed to be in God's eyes. Because it's people that help me see my shortcomings, and it's people that help me see the good things about myself. I have two children. I have a boy who's going to be 15 in about 10 days. And for those of you who knew me when I first moved to Tallahassee in 93, maybe it seems impossible that he could be almost 15. It certainly does to me. And I also have a girl who just turned 6 last October. I am so thankful that God did not give me children before I got sober. I could not have done it. And I know that he knows that I couldn't do it. Not only did he know that I couldn't do it, but he gave them to me 9 years apart. Because if they were any closer, I can't tell you if I'd still be sober today. I love my kids. I cannot imagine my life without them. They are a challenge. And one of my sponsors recently reminded me that God is desperate for me to stay sober. And I was a little offended by that statement. And then he said, if he wasn't, he wouldn't give you so many challenges to work the steps with. And you know what? It's a really important point because when I'm faced with challenges, I am working the program. I am calling people. I am giving help. I'm going to meetings. I'm reading my big book. I'm on my knees. I'm grateful. I'm doing all the things I don't want to do that people tell me I should do. And so far, it's been working. But when my life is in a really good place, I don't need to go to meetings. I don't need to read my big book. I don't need to pray. I don't need to work with others. I am powerful. And it's that false sense of power that drove me to drinking. And so I have taken that very valuable piece of advice to heart. And I have, in just the last couple of weeks, been very grateful for the challenges that I've been given in sobriety, because Div is right. If I didn't have those challenges, I wouldn't probably be sober today. Ian talked about a little bit of my life in the 5 years that he's known me, and I can share a little bit of it just to let you know how the steps have worked for me. I was, I don't know how many years sober, I guess I was 15 years sober, and I had been married for a little over 5 years to a man who's not in the program. And we had what looked like on the outside a great life, and somehow I must have been in that phase of my development where I needed to learn that it didn't matter what it looks like, pay attention to how it feels, you know, and I kept thinking, well, it looks so good, it should probably be good. In truth, it wasn't. Wasn't a very good relationship, and maybe there was too many stressors on me that I stayed sober, and that's really the only important thing, and I'd sometimes get into analyzing what went right and what went wrong. Anyway, I did lose everything. I lost the husband, and I lost a home, and I lost my credit, and I lost, and I lost, and I lost. And, you know, it's a new level of learning how to deal with my own vanity. I didn't want people to see this happening to me. And at the same time, there wasn't any way to hide it. I went to meetings in desperation at times, where the only thing I could say is that I was grateful to be sober and that I hadn't picked up a drink. And for someone with 15 years of sobriety, that's pretty hard to do, you know, because the should-be's start coming in. Oh, you should be grateful to this, you should be grateful to that, and, you know, should-be, should-be. Oh, shoot, forget it. I wasn't grateful about anything. And it was a time in my life that I hope I never have to experience again, where every time I turned my head, I had some kind of new hardball coming at me. And it wasn't necessarily just from the marriage, but it was from a lot of different places. I was in the process of finishing my doctorate degree, which is what brought me to Tallahassee in the first place. And I don't know how I did it. I can look back today and say, I really don't know how I did it. And you know what? I really didn't do it. It was the people in the program that did it. They carried me. God carried me. My big book carried me. Day after day, you know, I was losing things, and I was losing people, and I was, I don't know. There's a great book out written by a recovering alcoholic called The Camel Knows the Way, and it's about a woman who loses everything in her 15th year, and interestingly enough, I read it in my 14th year. So I had that, too. I kept falling back on how she did it, and she'd been on the high society side of things in New York, and she managed to make it, and I managed to make it. I had to do things that I didn't want to do. And that's pretty much, I think, been the history of my recovery, is doing things that I didn't want to do. You know, I did not want to surrender to alcoholism. I did not want to surrender to a higher power. I didn't even want to believe there was anything more powerful than myself, let alone surrender to it. I did not want to look at my character defects, and I certainly didn't want to give up those that I thought were working for me. And I got a few of them that I'm still using, let me tell you. Darn it, I hate it when I have to be honest. You know, just lost my own train of thinking. Huh. Anybody want to remind me where I was? No, you're not in my head. It's a good thing. It's not a good place to be sometimes. There's somebody down around this area, and I haven't seen him here today, that used to say going into my own head is like going into a bad neighborhood alone at night. And boy, I can relate to that. I think about it a lot. The other day I told my son he had a distorted thinker, and then I looked in the mirror and thought, oh, no, I got the distorted thinker, too. And I can take anything and turn it around into, oh, somebody said you can trip over a mountain, but you can't climb over a molehill. And I thought, yeah, boy, that makes sense to me. I can't. Oh, well, I don't know where I was going with any of that, but I would like to share with you when I truly knew I was alcoholic and surrendered. Oh, I was talking about life in the last 5 years. Oh, yeah, well, I'll wrap that up later. I was on a trail ride in August, right after I had been to the family treatment center. And there was, I think, 240 riders, which meant there was probably 500 people, because sometimes the spouses didn't ride. Anyway, a lot of people out in the middle of this hayfield in northern Illinois. hot and humid like it is here. Sticky and stinky. I mean, think about all those horses. Anyway, we were on this ride, and a police officer drove up to the area where my group of friends were, and asked for my significant other, you know, the one who had all the horses at my farm, and I, and he wanted to tell us about a friend of ours that had been up from Texas visiting with her husband who had died the night before. And the story kind of went like this. They were out drinking and partying, and they weren't on the trail ride. And she wanted to go one place, and he wanted to go to another place, and it was somewhere between 2:30 and 4 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, I know exactly what their state of mind was then. And he didn't want to take her where she wanted to go, and so she decided she was going to go there on her own. And I don't know that Deb weighed much over 100 pounds, and she somehow managed to open the door of the truck, and he drove over and killed her. And somewhere there's some serious alcoholism or alcoholic thinking going on there, and I could relate to that. However, I hadn't had a drink, you know, now in about 5 weeks. And so everyone decided that night that they were going to go into town and have a drink and celebrate Deb's leaving. And I can tell you today that I can get nervous about the fear I had about going into town with everyone to go do this, because I wasn't going to drink. I hadn't had a drink in 5 weeks, and by God, I wasn't going to drink for any reason under the sun. And the next thing I knew, it was 6:15 in the morning, and I was puking my guts out, and I was absolutely unable to identify what happened the night before. I don't even remember rationalizing the first drink, but I do remember thinking, this is insanity, that you would pick up a drink and get drunk in memory of someone who was so heavily under the influence that she was able to do what she did. And that was the first connection for me of the true insanity of my alcoholism. And I'm happy to say that that was the end of my consumption time as well. I sat in that tent, and I asked God to help me at that moment, because I knew I could no longer do it alone, and I knew that it was crazy making, and I knew that I probably wouldn't live much longer if I continued to think and do what I was doing. I hope I never, ever forget that level of helplessness and hopelessness, because that is truly what was the beginning of turning that connection between my higher power and I around. I knew there was nowhere else to go. I came back from that trail ride, and I had been given a phone number from the treatment center I had been at and suggested that I should call her when I got back to Illinois, and I had not. And I knew it was now time to call Roxanne. And just a note on sponsorship. For me, I would not be here today sober if I had not had consistent sponsorship throughout the years. I'm the kind of person, like I said, I can't be alone, and so I haven't even tried to do this alone, as I knew I would fail. I mean, it's too lonely for me. I have to have people around. I called Roxanne, and she was the best thing that happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. She was so kind, and she was gentle, and we could work the steps as my problems arose, and that was what I needed, I thought. Now, she had a sponsor. His name was Kathy. And I was in my middle late 20s, and Kathy was like 19, and she already had been sober for about 5 years, and just that made me angry. You know, how did she 5 years of sobriety, and she's 10 years younger than I am, and she was hardcore. I didn't like her at all. It took me years to like her. And every time Roxanne would go out of town, because I couldn't be alone, I would have to call Kathy. And, yeah, Kathy made me work. She really made me work. You know, I think she liked it when Roxanne went out of town, because she could really put it to me, go, work, get to meetings, clean those ashtrays. That's when you could still smoke at meetings. Make that coffee. You can stay and sweep up the floor. In fact, we had a meeting house that you actually got real cups and saucers, and we had to wash them when we were done. I didn't wash dishes then. I didn't have to. You know, I used paper at home. I just threw it away. Anyway, I started to work the steps. Life got better. The significant other left in December. The horses left in February. Took a while to get them out. And I started to clean up the mess I had made with my life. And I'm still working on cleaning up the mess in my life. the thing also I guess I should share with anybody that's fairly new in sobriety in here is that they talk about changing your playgrounds and your playmates. And, that was really hard because I had this commitment to all these people. And not only commitment, but I'd been supplying their drugs and alcohol for a long time, and they were still coming around, and I was carrying a big book. Didn't work. Didn't work at all. It was one of those really hard things. It did say something about the exit signs when he first started talking, and you know, all you have to do is walk out the door to get out of the fire. And I thought, man, I wish AA was that easy. You just have to walk out of the door and life will get good. And you walk out the door and then you have to start climbing the hill. But with each step, you get a better view of life. And I did it again. I think, I don't know if it's age or if it's the number of brain cells I damaged when I was little, but... Yeah, oh, I was cleaning up my life, thanks. The wreckage of my past. Today, those wreckages are really helpful because it's amazing how many people come into your life that you can share your experience, strength, and hope with. And each time I share it, I'm a little bit more proud of the wreckage I had because I was able to take care of it. And again, clearly not alone. I was going to touch a little bit on some of the wreckages and being able to share with people. I had a sponsee a number of years ago who... This is just a funny story. I hope everyone thinks it's funny. Who went on a trip, and she decided to take some condoms with her because she thought maybe she would fall in love on this 3-day weekend. See, a number of you can relate to that. I think I was about 8 or 9 years sober when I was sponsoring her. She came back, and she had a huge resentment. I thought, all I could do was look at her and say, how did you think you were going to get to a point with another human being where you would want to have that kind of action going on in 3 days? You know what? When I was drinking, it only took a few hours, maybe. You know, girl, thank God I don't have to live that way today. Thank God I have some sense of boundaries and, you know, an interest in getting to know someone for who they are. What they might have to help me in my life journey. You know, none of those things mattered before. I like to share that because it is kind of a good story. And it wraps up in my own head the way I used to think about life. It was about me. And how could someone not want to go to bed with me after 3 days, you know? That I hadn't picked up a drink. And trying to hold on to the home until my kids finished school. I went into major debt to my parents. It was really wonderful for anybody who still has their parents to watch them come into their parenting role again when you're 40. I am eternally grateful because had they not stepped in, I would have not been able to finish professionally what I was trying to do. I would be in a whole different place. And it's scary to think, much like it is scary to think today in our political situation, that I could have been born in a different country and my life would be different. I could have been born to different parents and my life would be different. And even though I may not have been alcoholic, I wouldn't have what I have today. And I wouldn't trade anything in my life today for anything. I love who I am. I love where I am. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, the strength it's given me, the self-love it's given me, the ability to love other people, honestly, without motivation, without looking for something for myself. And what happened at the end of the school year, 2 years ago almost, was that I packed up my children and I put all my things in storage and I stepped out on total faith that my life would fall into place. I had a new degree. I hadn't worked in a couple of years. I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought I was going to teach. I had a couple of interviews, and each one had a different outcome. Got offered a job I didn't want. Didn't get offered a job I wanted. Got offered a job I wanted, and then the money wasn't there. I took my kids to Michigan to stay with my mother for the summer, which we had done a number of summers in a row to escape the heat. And I stuck a little ad in the newspaper, you know, half inch by inch, that said, I'm a speech therapist. It said speech therapy, summer speech therapy. And I am honored to tell you what God has done for me from that one little ad. I am not teaching. I don't know why. I really do want to teach. And someday I think that door will open. I'm trying to practice patience with it. I have a practice that has two other speech therapists working part-time in it. I have a real secretary now. For 3 weeks, she's been there daily. She answers the phone. She actually schedules my day. And let me tell you, if you have a chance to ever have that, it is great. It keeps me out of trouble. When I have to schedule my own day, holy moly, I have two and three things happening at the same time. I am grateful for that. My kids are very, very happy. They're very centered. Out of this last almost two-year period of time, I spent about 15 months with my mother in her basement, two bedrooms, three of us, and a dog. I have a Dalmatian dog. Again, it's a bonding that came about that I would have never had an opportunity to have. I do have to say that we didn't really part as close as I would have liked to have parted, but we survived it. And that's a big deal, and some women in here are shaking their head because women going home to their mothers with their own children is a mission in itself. It is a whole new working of the 12 steps. It's a whole new working of principles before personalities. And it was good for me. It was good for my children. They have the experience of living with their grandmother for over a year, and there's a love and a bond and experiences that they will never forget. I have the wonderful experience of meeting lots of new women and helping them. I have Jennifer here with me, which is so cool to think that somebody likes me enough to want to travel all the way to Florida. She came on Thursday on a different plane than obviously I came on, and she's been here for a day and a half on her own, doing her own 12-step work. I don't know. I don't know if there's anything that I haven't finished up, but I do know that I am very, very happy, and I'm very, very pleased to be here and to share whatever I shared that may have touched another person out there in the room. I hope that I've carried, if nothing more, a message of hope, and that it's, even if it's only a mustard seed in size, that you will let it grow and be willing to be a part of it and to honestly be moving forward in your recovery and sharing it with other people. That's truly what is so exciting for me, and it's motivating. Back to that motivation word. When I was a drinking person, I didn't have motivation for anything except my next drink. I tried to think back, was I really motivated to go to school, or did I do it out of necessity? I did it out of necessity to make enough money to feed my addiction. Was I really motivated to be a good friend? No. I was good friends because I needed something that somebody else had, and I found a way to get it through manipulation, deceit, dishonesty. I really couldn't think of a thing that I was motivated for before I came into recovery. Today, when I get up, there's a lot of days I really don't want to go to work, but I'm certainly motivated and willing to live life on life's terms. I don't really care what comes at me. As Viz said, as long as I have a challenge, I know I'm going to be working the steps. As long as I'm working the steps, I'm fairly guaranteed that I'll stay sober for the next 24 hours, and that's really all I have to stay focused on right now is that one problem today, how can I get through it? And all kinds of benefits and rewards come true. The promises have all come true for me over and over and over again. You know, the whole fear of economic insecurity two or three years ago, it was just a whole new surrender for dealing with that fear of economic insecurity. I move in and out of it as everybody does, and certainly because of the way our country is right at the moment. But I do have to tell you that hanging on and doing it one day at a time, it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life. And I'm really honored to be here to have shared that with you today. Thanks.